We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. Much of what's been written about America's involvement in international affairs concentrates on the Atlantic, that coast of the United States, and our connections with Europe. However, as our guest for this hour, historian Bruce Cummings, points out, America is the first world power to occupy a landmass that is open at both ends to the world's two largest oceans. That, he says, has given this country a great competitive advantage. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Bruce Cummings about his new book. The title of his book is Dominion from Sea to Sea, Pacific Ascendancy and American Power. The book is recently published by the Yale University Press and takes a look at the importance of the West, the Pacific, and connections to East Asia, and how all of those things have played an important role in American history, the many ways that relations with Asia particularly have influenced our history. The book is out now if you'd like to take a look at it. And, of course, as we talk, questions are welcome now. We hope people will be brief in their comments. That'll help us to keep the program moving. But, of course, comments are welcome. Comments and questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, your call is welcome. Our guest, Bruce Cummings, is chair of the History Department at University of Chicago, is a specialist in the history of modern Korea. He has written for a number of publications, including the New York Review of Books, the New Left Review, the London Review of Books, and The Nation. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And Professor Cummings, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You, in the book, talk about having some personal connections with the West Coast. I know you did some of your growing up there. But something here that I just have to ask you about, that you say that at the point where you were a graduate student at Columbia, you saw a movie. The movie was Chinatown, and you write here in the book that, in fact, you write here in the book that for the first time in your life ever, you stayed to see it a second time. So that movie apparently really made an impression on you, and I think you say in the book that maybe that was where you started thinking about the importance of the West and the importance of California.
Well, that is true. I was dawdling around waiting to defend my dissertation at Columbia, and there was a $2 movie on the Upper West Side. I went to see Chinatown in the afternoon and then stayed on a second time. The film attracted me initially because as a person trying to be an expert on East Asia, what Robert Towne, the scriptwriter, and Roman Polanski, the director, had done was to take a lot of stereotypes of Chinese communities, Chinatowns, that they were run by criminal deviants, inscrutable people, given to mayhem and general bad behavior, and sort of translate that stereotype from Chinatown in Los Angeles and make it the stereotype of the WASP, white Anglo-Saxon male elite that ran Los Angeles before World War II. Scholars talk about the theory of the Asiatic mode of production, or sometimes called Oriental despotism, where you have a dictator that moves a lot of water and into deserts using corvée labor, slave labor, things like that. And Los Angeles, of course, is a city that wouldn't exist. It was a mudflat 200 years ago, and it wouldn't exist if it were not for the delivery of enormous amounts of water, mainly from the Colorado River. And the elites of Los Angeles understood that water was the lifeline not just to the city but to vast wealth. And so it seemed to me that there was this kind of East Asian connection to it that had been dramatically reversed because we see the stereotypes of Chinatown in the film. And Jack Nicholson, as Jake Gittes, worked in Chinatown as a detective and said, you know, you never know what was going on there. And then he translated that into, you really don't know what's going on with this great city of Los Angeles. And then just to finish this off, I later on began reading about Los Angeles and came to understand that Chinatown really deals with a kind of collapsed history that is at the center of the rise of that great city. And so Los Angeles plays a particular role in my book, mainly as an unbelievably rapidly developing protean city that most New Yorkers don't like and many Americans don't know much about unless they happen to visit it.
And perhaps just to take that a step further, I think for you, the state of California has that same quality. And is it correct to say that you're making this argument in the book that the future of that California, in a sense, represents the future direction of America?
Yeah, if that were my only argument, it would be nothing new. My parents moved to Palo Alto, California in 1962 when I was 18 years old, and they voted with their wheels, so to speak, as many other Americans did. That was the year when California became the most populous state in the nation. But California, of course, is... I mean, if you just look at its gross domestic product, it ranks with Italy, and in many ways it's our own private Italy, sitting out there on the West Coast with a climate not unlike Italy, and in particular very sharp differences between Northern California and Southern California, just as there are in Italy. But it's been, for our economy, a kind of gift that just keeps on giving. And the latest example of that is the Silicon Valley boom of the 1990s that's really continuing today with Google and a bunch of other things. But it started in the 1880s, and it's, except for a couple of years, in the early 90s and in the last year, population in-migration has always been greater than out-migration in California. So it's, I mean, if it didn't exist, we wouldn't be able to invent it, I think. But it's been a tremendous asset to the country. And yet the cultural center of the country is really in the Northeast quadrant, Boston, New York, Washington, and lots of those folks don't really either know much about Southern California or the state or think much of it.
Yeah. Well, that provides an answer to what would be my next question, and that is why it is, you know, given the fact that the United States does have – occupy the landmass that it does, and it does border on these two oceans, and that you have to acknowledge the importance of the West in American history. Given all of that, why is it that the kind of Pacific perspective that you're writing about in the book doesn't get more attention from historians or perhaps from anybody else?
Well, for historians, you have a voluminous literature on the American West, and there's plenty about California in it. And you have a less weighty literature on America in the Pacific, basically going back to the mid-19th century, but hardly anything that would try to link the expansion westward, the Asian pioneers who came to the U.S. At the same time most American pioneers did during the white pioneers did during the Gold Rush, and our Pacific involvements that began right after the completion of the continent, with California being brought into the Union after the war with Mexico. I mean, 4 or 5 years later, you have, 1853, you have Commodore Perry in Tokyo, and rarely do people make connections between the war with Mexico and expansion to the Pacific. So I wanted to try and bridge those two literatures, but I've written for a broader audience as well, and I'm particularly interested in trying to understand the non-Atlanticist aspects of American power in the world. Atlanticism is the dominant tendency in our foreign policy. It was always the reference point during the Bush years for critics of the Bush foreign policy, which was unilateralist and got us in trouble with our friends in Europe and so on. But really, since World War II and Pearl Harbor, the Atlanticist narrative has been dominant. But it doesn't really explain the kind of relations that we have with Japan or South Korea or China, Taiwan, the Philippines, which are heavily militarized, we have our troops on the territory of Japan and South Korea so long after World War II and the Korean War, I don't see the kind of alphabet soup organizations that developed in Europe like NATO. I don't see in East Asia the kind of collegial multilateralism that it typifies our relations with the Atlantic, or at least should. And so I wanted to develop a pacifist argument about the importance of the Pacific to the American position in the world, but I couldn't use the term pacifist because it's a synonym for pacifist, and that isn't what I'm getting at. When you look at where Barack Obama just departed from his home state of Hawaii, you can go to drive around Pearl Harbor, and you will see just across from Ford Island the headquarters of CINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief Pacific, and that is the centerpiece or the center of an extraordinary dominance by American military power throughout the entire ocean, which is two-thirds of all the oceans in the world, all the water in the world. And 52% of the territory of our planet Earth is allegedly under the command of CINCPAC. So there's never been a country that has dominated any ocean, let alone the biggest one like we have since 1941, without really any serious challenge. And so I have a whole chapter on the military nature of much of our interaction with East Asia. I don't want to overemphasize that. I try to understand that trade has been an enormous aspect of those relations as well. But there isn't the kind of cultural connection that has always existed between the U.S. And Europe in general and England in particular. And that's really what I try to focus on in the first part of my book, to try to understand why the enormous economic, military aspects of our involvement in the Pacific have not translated into a kind of cultural prominence, if not preeminence, on the part of, say, the cities on the West Coast.
Just very quickly, let me introduce again the guest for this hour at Focus 580. Bruce Cummings is chair of the History Department at the University of Chicago. He specializes in modern Korean history. He is the author of a recently published book that we're talking about. The title is Dominion from Sea to Sea, Pacific Ascendancy and American Power. It's published by the Yale University Press, and as he has explained, looks at the importance of the West, of the West Coast, the Pacific Ocean, connections to East Asia, what all of that has meant for America and American history. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. If it were not for the West, for the perception that Easterners had that it was this vast paradise, empty of anyone important, leading to the Pacific and the idea that it was destiny that we should occupy that space, would in fact we have developed a larger kind of sense of manifest destiny that then translates into a certain kind of foreign policy? I mean, is that a line that you can follow from where we are now all the way back?
Well, I tried to, in a fairly brief form, explain how the continent came together in Five Easy Pieces, to borrow another Jack Nicholson film. The first piece, not so easy, was 13 colonies. And what's significant about them is the many, many decades and centuries that went by before anyone thought of trying to explore what might be off to the west. And that was both because of the difficulty of transportation, the absence of accurate maps, and, of course, fearsome Native Americans who might give you a hard time if you went in that direction. So you have from the 1620s until the foundation of the United States in the 1780s, you have a fair, you know, essentially the 13 colonies hugging the Atlantic coast. It's Thomas Jefferson who really, unbeknownst to anybody, including the French, managed to get a third of the continent dropped into his lap in the Louisiana Purchase. And then to find out what he had purchased, he sent Lewis and Clark running off to reconnoiter the continent. And one of the, I mean, I'm sure historians of this period are very well aware of all of this, but I was surprised to find out the degree to which the continental dimension of the United States was so recent. It really is a matter of maps finally understanding that we had a continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific in the 1830s. And Lewis and Clark reconnoitering, you know, the upper Northwest to Oregon. But maps up until that period showed California as an island, just like somebody feeling the tail of an elephant and thinking they have a hold of an ox or something. The Baja Peninsula was where the Spanish landed, and they didn't ever go much into the interior until much later, and so California literally lay fallow for about 300 years of the history of the modern world, to be discovered really only with the Gold Rush and brought into the Union. So you have the 13 colonies, the Louisiana Purchase, California and Texas coming into the Union in the 1830s and 40s. James Polk, who is a much underestimated president, also makes a deal with the British on the border with Canada, so we get the Oregon and Washington territories. And then Seward comes along and buys Alaska, and that's essentially the five pieces that formed the continent. But the awareness that this was a continental country is just about 150, 160 years old. And that meant that the virgin land, as a Harvard professor called it wasn't virgin, of course, but it was occupied by Native Americans who ultimately could not resist our expansion westward. That virgin land was unbelievably fallow for development with all the techniques of the modern world at hand. In other words, California's first big expansion was in agriculture, and since the land had never been divided up into small plots, you could put gigantic combines in the 1880s and grow wheat in California and ship it all the way to England if you wanted to. That was the first big spurt of the California economy, but it was also literally a matter of the most productive agricultural land in the world, first being exploited by machines. So the whole narrative of the yeoman farmer, the homestead, all of that doesn't apply to California. And it remains by far the largest agricultural state in its production every year, while also, of course, having Silicon Valley and enormous industries in Southern California. So it was quite a continent in the sense that when California and the Pacific states were finally developed, all this land and all of this was there for people who were already modern to come in and develop it very rapidly. And I don't know others who have said that. Probably someone will call up and say, oh, no, that was said 50 years ago. But I think it's one of the most important parts of my book because you end up with a completed industrial continental economy running from Boston through the very strong Midwest economy out to California, and it's all on stream and developing after World War II in tandem.
Yeah. Well, I think you'd certainly do make the point that what happens with the westward move is the change in character of America from what early America, what really was an agrarian society, and where the ideal was the yeoman farmer. And I suppose, you know, some people would argue that at least at that time, and maybe in some people's minds, still the ideal American is Tom Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this really changes when you move west, when you start to see the growth of Midwestern industrial cities, the application of industrial techniques to agriculture, and then perhaps the emergence of a new man as the ideal American. I don't know who that would be, whether that's Andrew Jackson or Abraham Lincoln or, you know, Bill Cody or, you know, I don't know who, but and then on to somebody like Bill Gates maybe.
I just wanted to say one more thing about your earlier question that I didn't answer, the part about manifest destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I have come to be a complete determinist about manifest destiny, and that I think all of that heated rhetoric about the West and moving to China, the Orient, uniting the Occident and the Orient, I mean, they went on and on. It all flows from the completion of the continent and the enormous industrial dynamism of the U.S. in the 1840s with railroads and all kinds of other machines that created a kind of great leap forward in that period before the Civil War, so that it just was awaiting a politician to come along and talk about something like manifest destiny. But I think you put your finger on something, which is Thomas Jefferson as the Arcadian guide to what America ought to look like, and that would be the small independent farmer, but middle class, a Democrat with a small D, resisting the power of the state, and generally not liking cities all that much. So along comes Frederick Jackson Turner, right across the road from where I'm talking to you. He gave his 1893 address at the Columbian Exposition here in Chicago, talking about the frontier as the essential way to understand the development of American, especially American democracy. It's a very Jeffersonian text. But within years, he was looking at Chicago and Cleveland and Detroit and other cities and wondering what the industrialists had wrought. So a kind of industrial machine chews up the Arcadian garden that Jefferson and the historian Turner deeply believed in. So their narrative really has no way to explain a city like Chicago that grew up on the prairie in just a few decades to be such a dominant industrial city. And it says nothing about California. It does say something about Oregon, for example, which, Portland, Oregon was named Portland because of the existence of Portland, Maine. And people from Maine came there, and what they wanted to do in Oregon was establish another New England. And that was a very strong pattern in westward expansion. And in some ways, Oregon is what New England would look like, or what Maine would look like if it were on the Pacific coast. But California has no relationship to that narrative. It's always been an industrial state booming forward into the future.
Mm-hmm. We're almost at our midpoint here. We had some callers we'll get to. Our guest is Bruce Cummings. He's chair of the History Department at the University of Chicago and is a specialist on the history of modern Korea and has also written about East Asian relations. His new book is Dominion from Sea to Sea, Pacific Ascendancy and American Power. It's published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. We have some callers here. We'll get right to them. Again, please help us by being brief in your comments. We'll start with a caller in Indiana and line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The relationship between the Five Easy Pieces and Chinatown, are you just using Polanski's aesthetics, or do you think he's got a hold of something in terms of how you make movies and the narration from that would explain things in a more subtle way about what you've been talking about? Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. Of course, Polanski was not involved with Five Easy Pieces, but he was the director of Chinatown. And I think that film has a great importance as an historian in that it collapses but doesn't really violate the chicanery involved in bringing the Los Angeles Aqueduct and the water first of the Owens River and Lake and then later the Colorado River to L.A. to fertilize it and to make fortunes for people like Noah Cross, who was the protagonist and the cook in Chinatown. As I said earlier, Chinatown also had a brilliant inversion of typical white stereotypes of Chinese communities, which were inverted and made relevant to understanding a person like Noah Cross. I think that film is one of the great films of the 20th century, quite apart from its narrative of L.A.'s history. It's ostensibly a film noir, but it's bathed in nostalgia for a vanished Los Angeles when you had citrus trees, lemon groves, and orange groves all over the place. One of the most beautiful environments ever created in the United States, and of course it was all created by adding water to the desert. And much of the narrative of Los Angeles is a fallen narrative, a falling away from a glorious past, especially the Orange Grove past, because the realtors did this and the oil men did that and the politicians were too stupid to stop it. You have a whole literature on Los Angeles that treats it as a failed utopia or an Arcadia that was ruined by the developers. And what I try to do in the book is show that that's an American narrative almost from the word go. I quote someone saying most of the frontier from Ohio through Pennsylvania was up for sale in the 1810s or 1820s. Land speculation was part and parcel of the westward movement all along the way. And there are many other cities, including San Francisco, where the delivery of water was involved with people buying land very cheaply, and then when it was watered, making enormous fortunes from selling it. But I think if I were both an historian and a filmmaker, the ideal film for me would be one like Chinatown, which raises questions about history that then can be answered or explored by looking at the historians who've actually written about all that. William Carl, K-A-H-R-L, has a very, very good book on water and power in California that shows you the sort of substantive history behind a film like Chinatown that, you know, on its surface is just a crime drama.
All right. Let's go to Effingham, line one. Hello.
Yes, thanks, David, for taking my call. A couple of things. The indigenous peoples and how they were affected, I still think it was a huge criminal activity that's still going on, only as you've suggested that in the East Asia and what we are doing, you know, with the excuse of 9/11 to Middle East, I think it's all been predictable. But nevertheless, the Industrial Revolution, I think, touched off what the subject matter of this conversation is. My other point would be, don't forget the Spanish. They were on the seas before, you know, while the Western Europeans were still crossing the Atlantic. They were on the high sea, you know, started by Columbus and all that stuff, and began to invade and wipe out indigenous peoples wherever they went, and then took over, I think, if I looked at the map right, the Western North America. Well, when they couldn't hold on, and they finally failed, and then the U.S. began, as you said, with Admiral Perry and other people who then took up all those old possessions like the Philippines and then on into what was what I would think the seaboard of Asia itself. And to understand that and what the effects are and what the effects still are and how the U.S. is currently the biggest hegemon in the world, then can do what they want to do. And I'll end with this, that the only thing left for the U.S. to encounter and to execute will be nuclear weapons upon those supposed terrorists. Thank you.
Well, there's a lot there. You can pick and choose what you might want to talk about.
Well, the first point about indigenous peoples is a major point in my book that we haven't talked about yet, and I appreciate him bringing it up. I think a fundamental difference between an Atlanticist perspective and a Pacific perspective is that people who live across the Atlantic are people that we respected and learned from and modeled ourselves on, primarily the British, but also other Western European, Northern European nations. That was an inheritance that was always treated with respect and with a slight sense that maybe Americans weren't doing it as well as they did with Roman and Greek civilization, Western civilization in general. With the Pacific, you get almost no cultural communication until recently, and leading literary critics that I quote in my book talking about how wonderful it is to be a Europhile, and on the other hand, about the vast void of the Pacific. And the void is one of a lack of cultural communication. This is a literary critic's high-minded way of saying that we haven't been able to respect any of the people in the wake of our westward march. First of all, the Native Americans, masses of whom were killed, mostly by disease, but also by violence. 1 in 25 Indians living in Mexico managed to survive the Spanish onslaught, and it wasn't much better in North America. When the Chinese came in as laborers, first in the gold rush, and then with the building of the Western railroads, they were subjected to gross discrimination. It was not slavery, but it was something close to that in terms of the lynchings and the violence and the banishment, the deportation, is kicking people out, Chinese out of whole communities. And a kind of Jim Crow situation lasted into the early 1960s on the West Coast for Asian Americans, not to mention other people of color like blacks and Chicanos. So I think that is one of the most difficult and unfortunate aspects of our march to the Pacific, but it's one that still colors our relations with East Asian countries. I end the book by talking about what I'm sure will be the most important relationship of the 21st century, that between the U.S. and China. And I think that we need to come to an understanding that the Chinese are a formidable people, a good partner, one we can learn a great deal from. Because if we try to treat them the way we have, say, the Japanese or the Koreans, I think it's going to be a very long century. Now, I'd have to unpack that generalization I just made because our relations with Japan have been very good since World War II, but the fact is we went to war with Japan and defeated them before that kind of a relationship could be possible, and it's still one in which the Japanese are dependent on us for defense and in many ways subordinate to us diplomatically. So I think you can go back to the 1840s and come forward and ask the question, what people in our van or in our wake have we truly respected as we've marched to the West? My deep hope is that the extraordinary diversity of the West Coast and the prominence of Asian Americans, for example, in Silicon Valley, where about 40% of the professionals in Silicon Valley are Asian American, will create a situation of diversity and understanding and self-awareness so that we can live out the century peacefully with China.
Perhaps we'll come back to this conversation about our future relations with the major powers of East
right.
Asia. I have another caller here, though. I want to get to them. They've been holding for a bit in Belgium. Line two. Hello.
Hello, and welcome to a new decade. Hope it's better than the last one. The question I'd like to pose to you, or topic I might want to open up for you to discuss about, and I haven't heard you mention it quite yet, is that, you know, people input aspects into California. You know, we put water into it. We here in Illinois have put a lot of intelligence information into California, and they reap all the benefits and being called Silicon Valley. But a lot of that started right here at the University of Illinois years ago. And there's many things like that. We input pilgrims into it, and they give back a lot of food to the rest of the world, mainly to the United States. We put in actors and stuff, and they come back with all kinds of new trends we want to deal with. We put stuff into California, but then they spit it back out to us, and we slavishly think it's new and different and the most modern thing. I find that really interesting. We don't seem to do that to the East Coast. We do it to the West Coast, though. Could you talk about that?
Well, I do talk about it in the book probably more than I should have. I became fascinated by the story of Netscape coming out of the University of Illinois in the form of the Mosaic web browser that Jim Clark, who founded Netscape, then came along and essentially, I don't want to say he stole it because that's never been proved in a court. There was an out-of-court settlement, but he took Mosaic, and he took the young men who put Mosaic together, and he founded Netscape, which at least for a time was one of the great corporations in Silicon Valley, and made him a billionaire. That story I go into in some detail, and it is exactly as you say, that the invention of web crawlers or internet browsers did happen at the University of Illinois with some help from Tim Berners-Lee before, and then it was just poached and taken out to the West Coast. One of the reasons that kind of thing happens is the enormous interest of the American state in development on the West Coast. It's true that Illinois had a Defense Department mainframe computer that was the beginning of Mosaic and things like that, or supercomputer. But the state had such a deep interest in the development of various firms, especially those making silicon chips and guidance systems for missiles and all of that, so that their attention, especially the attention of the Pentagon's Advanced Research Project Agency, was so focused on the West that you get a synergy of a lot of people, a lot of firms, a lot of government money. And you get a guy like Jim Clark, who literally comes back to Urbana-Champaign while he's recruiting these people and trying to poach Mosaic and talking about how the Italian restaurants aren't up to his standard. I make a bit of fun of him for that. But I think ultimately Illinois, the other Midwestern states, were settled states by the 1830s, 1840s. They don't represent a kind of virgin land, whereas California just continuously moves from one industrial leap to another because it wasn't ever settled in the way that Illinois was, and it came into the Union so much later. That isn't going to make you feel any better, but I fundamentally think you're right. I mean, even the earliest combines that were used on California's great farms in the 1880s were from Kalamazoo, Michigan, so-called Kalamazoo combines that were shipped out there. So it is a matter of constantly poaching on the advances of the East and the Midwest and then implementing them in California.
We have about 10-12 minutes left. I want to thank the caller and go on and again introduce our guest, Bruce Cummings. He's chair of the History Department at University of Chicago, has written a lot on the history of modern Korea. His author of the award-winning book, The Origins of the Korean War. He's also written for New York Review of Books, New Left Review, London Review of Books, The Nation. His new book is Dominion from Sea to Sea, Pacific Ascendancy and American Power. It's about the role that the West, the move westward, the Pacific Coast, connections to East Asia, what all of that has meant for American history. A Yale University Press is the publisher. We have another caller here. Others welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, folks can help us by being brief. We're coming into our last 10-12 minutes. Here's a caller in Champaign County. Hello.
No, point taken. It's an interesting line you're talking about right now. It seems to me moving technical things is one thing, and that can be exploited anywhere, but it's sort of, to my mind, it's more the federal policy and the amount of defense spending that is put in various areas, Colorado Springs, it comes to mind, the black budget, and then the defense spending in California would be a interesting chart to see. But I actually wanted to ask you about Korea a bit, if I can digress now, because I think you and a few others, Selig Harrison,
yeah.
One of the sort of the few dissonant voices on what I think is a complete misinterpretation of U.S.-Korean relations to some extent, and Chalmers Johnson fits in there as well, and is very pessimistic about prospects on. But it just seems to me that sort of the basic idea of the impasse with Korea, I mean, is just not treated fairly at all. I don't see you actually very much on PBS NewsHour anymore. I don't know if you've been contacted lately. But I don't know if in the few minutes that are left, you could sort of outline a dissident view, I mean, which would include the fact that you know, where else in the world is there this 50-year, and what is it now, state of war? I mean, there's never anything but an armistice in the region. And I just, the U.S., a good example, I guess, is the U.S. Declaims the military in Korea shooting off a missile over Japan, but the annual huge military maneuvers that U.S. and South Korea do are not regarded as provocative to the other side. Mm-hmm. So I get called a communist when I bring up this subject. So I don't know how people attack you, but I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't complain about my position. I've been lucky to be on the Lehrer NewsHour and various other places over the years, and shows like this. It is, though, my original perspective when I went in the Peace Corps to Korea in 1967 that has made me look with different eyes and a different perspective on Atlanticism, because we still don't have officials in Korea that really respect the Korean people and treat them as equals. We just had a round of that when President Noh-Myung-hyun, who is now deceased, was president for 5 years from 2002 to 2007, and the Bush administration treated him essentially as a person who had somehow gone astray and needed to be punished. The absence of equality in relationships, of multilateralism, of true consultations, this is one of the germs of my book. But when you look at the Korean War, which is called the Forgotten War here, and in many ways is a forgotten war, it was that war that touched off the transformation of the United States from a country that had a very small standing army and a very low defense budget under 1% of GNP for decade upon decade, into a country with a permanent army, a permanent national security state, and bases all over the world. It's true it would have happened if there had been a crisis somewhere else, probably, but the fact is it wasn't World War II so much as the Korean crisis that led to the situation where we have over 700 military bases around the world. I don't think it's an accident that Chalmers Johnson and Sally Harrison and myself, who have specialized on East Asia, have become critics of American foreign policy, not just there, but more generally, because we see the heavy militarized nature of it. Chalmers has written a lot on Okinawa. And I can bring this back to the caller's first point. You don't need to go find a chart to look at defense spending and how it's helped California. California was usually the leading state in the union in terms of defense contracts after Pearl Harbor. But what is unique about that spending on the West Coast, and it included Boeing up in Seattle and so on, is that it was all new industry. It was aircraft, it was aluminum, aerospace, rockets, computers, whereas the spending in Illinois, for example, on the south side of Chicago, they took an automobile factory in World War II and pumped a lot of defense dollars in it so that it made airplanes or airplane engines. That was very common throughout the Midwest, but it was a matter of retooling existing industry much more than founding new industry. So it's really World War II and the aftermath that founds the industrialization of the West Coast, and it's almost all state-directed and state-funded, which goes against the narrative of the free market and all of that, and is still generally not that well-known. I mean, I find people, you know, saying things about my book to me that I would have thought they knew already. Defense spending, the spending of the government on dams, on water, the Grand Coulee Dam, the Hoover Dam, all of these things that made it possible to live with modern civilization in the Western states are things that came out of Washington.
Another caller here to Champaign next, line two. Hello.
Bit surprised to hear you characterize it as we went to war with Japan, given the fact that Japan had been colonizing Korea for quite a number of years at that point, since the beginning of the 20th century, had colonized Manchuria and was waging a genocidal war in China to the extent that they could be successful at such things. So I wonder if at least maybe there needs to be a recasting of what you had to say. But I want to go to the future, which is what I'm much more interested in, is your point of view about China, given that to a certain extent, I think we have to look at it from the Chinese point of view, in the sense that China is an imperialist power in some sense. If you want to talk about what they're doing in Tibet and the genocide of the Tibetan people, what they're doing in the Uyghur areas, and what their issues with India in terms of border activity, their issues in terms of Southeast Asia, their general expansion, and also their expansion into Africa. So I think at least we need a balanced picture, and add to that the general repression in this Chinese society, this sort of trade-off between economic growth but repressive government and continual oppression of things that we would call human rights.
Yeah,
well, I think that I generally agree with what you said about China. It isn't a democracy. Its empire is very different than ours in that it expands in its along its borders. But still, there's no question that their treatment of Tibet is reprehensible. I try to argue in the book that not every problem in the world needs an American solution. And I go back all the way to John Quincy Adams on why is it that we need to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And I think that particular American strain, which began with Washington's farewell address and continued all through the 19th century as the dominant judgment on America's relationship to the world, is one that we need to recall and rethink and reflect upon. I did say we went to war with Japan, which is, of course, true. I mean, we did. I didn't say we started it. We had a Cold War with Japan going back to 1931, and that built up to the point where the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. If they had not attacked us, we would not have gone to war with Japan. So there's no question that they started that war, and we finished it. Our relations with Japan go back to Perry, of course, in 1853. And one of the things I didn't know when I researched this book is that Commodore Perry sat with his Japanese counterparts and said, by the way, did you notice that we had troops in Mexico City a few years ago during the war with Mexico, and you wouldn't want to have those troops in Edo or Tokyo. It was then called Edo. That was the implication. I hadn't known he had implicated, essentially threatened the use of force. But it certainly is part of a pattern in our relationships with countries in East Asia that recourse to the use of force or talk about the use of force is much more common. John Mearsheimer, my colleague, and Samuel Huntington both wrote very influential books which end with a 21st century war between the U.S. and China. I would rather see a situation where we try to get along peacefully with China, not think that we have all of the answers for China. But ultimately, I think what you're going to see is a vast panorama of Pacific civilization developing around a China that is showering its arid and semi-arid river valleys with great talent, just as we've done in California for the last 160 years. Ultimately, whether by force or by some other means, it will create a Pacific civilization that really doesn't exist now.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to come back to the United States. And an awful lot of history, both scholarly and popular, has been written about the impact of Europeans who came and landed on the East Coast, particularly in the latter half, I think, of the 20th century. And, you know, we have this sepia-toned portrait of Ellis Island that we've hung on the wall and tell all sorts of stories about that being the beginning point for a lot of people. Well, the same thing happened on the other coast, although it happened in a different way, and I'm not sure that people are quite so nostalgic, particularly Chinese Americans, about what that experience was like for them. But maybe as a way of finishing up, you could just talk a little bit about Asian influences in American culture and what that has meant for the country.
Well, it started with the gold rush when Asian laborers, Chinese laborers who had experience in the Yangtze River gorges were able to climb up the sheer face of granite mountains in the West, and I was talking about the gold rush. I meant to talk about the railroads, and stick dynamite and nitroglycerin in holes in high up on the face of these cliffs so that they could be blown away and the railway could go through. That particular Chinese expertise was then translated into both Japanese and Chinese agrarian expertise. Southern California by the 1910s was a place where Japanese farmers, so-called truck farmers, were becoming dominant under severe discrimination, but nonetheless with tremendous agrarian entrepreneurial skills. The Chinese also did a great deal to help the citrus groves and the general development of California agriculture, while constantly and always being kept away from melding with the mainstream of life. They would typically be brought to the fields, they would work, and then they would be expected to go back to Chinatown, where they lived on top of each other because of housing restrictions elsewhere. One of the problems we have with Asian Americans on the West Coast is that civil rights for Asian Americans really is as recent as it is for blacks. The Immigration Bill of 1965 brought many more Asians to the United States after immigrants were excluded from 1924 onward, and it finally lifted the kind of Jim Crow regulations that made it impossible for Chinese or Koreans or Japanese to live in various areas of L.A. or Portland or Seattle. So it's a long history of discrimination, but also a long history of tremendous contributions by Asian Americans who have been here since the gold rush.
I'm sorry to say, sorry to jump in on you, but I must, because we're here at the end of the time. Much, much more in the book. You can look at it. It's titled Dominion from Sea to Sea, Pacific Ascendancy and American Power, published by the Yale University Press, by our guest Bruce Cummings. He's chair of the History Department at University of Chicago. Professor Cummings, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.